Well, our next presenter really does not need an introduction. I'll do one anyway, because he's my friend. Jeff Welton has worked with Nautel for more than 30 years, more like 80. He is currently the Nautel sales manager for the U.S. Central Region. He spent 16 and a half years as a Nautel customer service technician, was involved in the 2015 MA3 field tests with the NEB labs, and has performed hundreds of transmitter site visits and field calls. Jeff has been recognized with the 2020 NAB Radio Engineering Achievement Award, the 2019 APRE Engineering Achievement Award, and the 2018 SBE Educator of the Year Award. He's also contributed to the most recent edition of the NAB Engineering Handbook, including authoring the chapter on facility grounding, and performs several presentations a year on topics relevant to broadcast engineering. So without further ado, my good friend, Jeff Welton.
You do the elbow bump. So I came back from Mississippi last week with COVID, which is not part of the presentation, thank God. But I got to give this presentation down there for a grand total of about, I think there were six people in the audience. So we're doing better today already. Ooh, they gave me a fancy new clicker, too. And somebody started the clock. Oh, look, I'm running over into the last. We got extra time. So has anybody here seen me talk about grounding before? None of you? Anybody heard me talk about transmitter site cooling before? This is going to be a rerun for a lot of y'all. But we're going to have some fun with it. I made them get me the headset mic because, you know me, I can't stand still, so I'm not even going to pretend to try. I don't know where I need to point this thing to make it work. Okay, what you call the, there we go. If I hold it this way, it's the down arrow. Gotcha. So we are going to talk about the lightning protection, about the air handling. Hardening the site more and more and more, we're running into physical access and security situations. How many people have had copper stolen from a site? How many people have had copper stolen from the same site more than once? It gets pricey. So a couple of things I discovered. One thing that's not in here, I discovered from a broadcaster in Vermont that barbed wire is an acceptable ground radial for an AM. I've discovered that if you pave over the near field around the base of the tower, it gets a whole lot harder to pull out the ground system. And if you tar copper strap, it gets a lot less value. Those are the three big takeaways from that. But that's the kind of thing. IT security. Is Ben in here? Ben Marth? No? Okay. I was joking at him earlier. Here's the thing. Is anybody here familiar with Shodan? If you don't know Shodan.io, you need to write that down, because if you do anything that you take away from this, and we'll get on it in a lot more detail later. But at this point in the game, I should not be able to access a Nautel transmitter running a default username and password on the public internet. This morning I did. I should not be able to access a Gates Air Maxiva UHF TV transmitter. I won't say that I did because that would be wrong. But there's one in Miami. I shouldn't be able to access 608 Barrix codecs, or a whole bunch of Comrex or Tylines, or pick your brand of choice. This stuff should not be visible online, but a lot of it is. We need to get better at that. The problem is that I'm preaching to the choir. Y'all are already doing the right things, or you wouldn't be sitting here learning more. It's the people that don't do these things we need to get to somehow. And every time it happens, every single time, there'll be a flurry of press releases and articles in Radio World and on the Broadcast Engineers Forum and on the I Take Pictures of Transmitter Sites. And every time it's like it's a brand new, oh my God, my barracks got hacked. Uh-huh. Now we've improved. This morning there were 608 barracks units visible online. When I first wrote this paper about 8 years ago, there were over 2,800. So yay us, I guess. Okay, so why do I keep pushing this talk? Why do I keep coming here talking about the same thing? This is the reason. How many SBE members in the room? Awesome, keep it up. Anybody who's not an SBE member should think about it. There's various reasons. I'm on the board of directors, so I'm biased, so I won't turn it into an SBE commercial. But there are many benefits. One of the things, their annual salary survey for everybody who fills it out is a huge data pool. So as of 2024, this is the average age of the broadcast engineer. Do you know that almost 20% of broadcast engineers right now are 66 or older? Think about that for a second. At an age when most people are thinking about retiring, 20% of us are still out there kicking it every day. Rock and roll. But that number is increased a lot over the last 20 years. And if it keeps going that way, it's not going to be a viable industry. So we need to fix that. All right. So grounding, and I'm not going to do in-depth grounding presentation. Like I said, half of you or more have heard me say that. I can point you to 15 different places where you can get that information. But I did this talk for the Alabama broadcasters about 4 hours ago. Turns out that, the Wi-Fi in my room is not good enough to support a Zoom call. My Max Connect couldn't get enough cell phone signal on the carrier it was running to support a cell phone call, a Max Connect backup. My personal, or my work iPhone on AT&T couldn't get enough signal to work as a hotspot. My personal phone, working on T-Mobile, saved the day. Three levels of backup to get the job done. Okay, belt, braces, suspenders, and staple your pants to your hips. Okay, and with grounding, we go the other way. Sometimes the minimalist approach is better. You can have, and Pat and I have had this discussion, you can have too many grounds. It happens a lot, especially if you've got an old site that has evolved. You know, this transmitter got replaced with this transmitter, so you ran a new strap from over there, and this strap got it ran to over there, and this one got cut, and we're not sure where it goes anymore. Grounding, I'll give you an example, plumbing. I'm dealing with this at home right now. So my upstairs, my house was built originally in my neck of the woods. A lot of times they'd build a basement and live in the basement while they could afford to build the rest of the house over top. It's not uncommon, even in this part of the world. Well, when they built the basement, they dug a septic system for it and plumbed it into the basement. When they built the upstairs, they dug a new septic system, put in a proper drain field, did it all right, and plumbed the upstairs into that, but left the downstairs into the original. At some point, somebody, who shall remain nameless but wasn't me, plumbed the upstairs kitchen and laundry room into a drain field going out the side of the lawn into a marsh beside the house. Which is fine until the building inspector sees it. And then at some point, somebody else plumbed that into the downstairs septic, which then got plugged. And at this point, I've got two septic systems and a drain field and no idea what's connected to what until it all backed up about 6 months ago and I had to go through and map the whole thing. By the way, you can also get a borescope, video borescope, with a 50-foot cable from Amazon for about $100. I mention that because it is also a really cool thing for looking down in that transmitter that you can't get into to figure out where that bolt went that you just dropped. Okay, it is arguably one of the coolest toys I have in the toolkit right now. So video borescope, some of them are better at a couple of feet than others, but just a little tool recommendation. Okay, so reference ground points. And what I've got drawn here is an example. If you had like a studio facility, you might have a ground in each room. Or if you've got a network TOC, you've got maybe a ground established for each rack. Then tie them all together to a common ground. Tie that to the building reference ground. What you don't do is daisy chain this thing to that thing to that thing to that thing to that thing, and then run them to ground, because you create paths for circulating currents. You lose control of where the lightning energy goes. So short straight runs. And the big thing, the big takeaway from this is we are playing a current divider game. We are shoving several thousand amps or tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands in some cases, amps of current down a tower to ground. Okay, that energy is looking for a place to dissipate. Ground has a resistance per foot, so if you don't have a pile of copper in there to provide a low impedance path, eventually you're going to see, what happens when you run a lot of current through a resistance, right? If I run 100,000 amps through earth, which has, say, an ohm per foot, that's 2 ohms. What's 100,000 times 2? 200,000. That's a lot of volts. That's why they tell you when you're in the field in a lightning storm, put your feet together and bend down and kiss your ass goodbye, but that's a whole different discussion. So we got to deal with this current divider. So we want the current to go in the places. By the way, some of you are going to recognize a few of these pictures. That one on the left, I am fairly certain, is Sears Tower, whatever they call it this week. Sears. Anyway, that's FMT, WFMT. That's Gordon's old site. But surge protection is critical, like a AC line protector. I think I've got a picture. We'll skip past those two for a couple. Oh, now let's go back to the horse stories. So this one, and I've used this one for years, and he's gone now, so I'm still not going to call him out by name, and I never did then either, although some of his folks have come and said, hey, we fixed that. I did this in Missouri. This was a site in Springfield, Missouri. And one of the engineers said, I remember when you were there, we fixed that, you know. And I said, good, send me the pictures. And he did. Not germane to this discussion, so they're not here, but I will, in my lightning protection, put the after pictures. If you have to cut the base plate from the building frame away to get to the ground rod, probably not a ground rod. This is the J-bolt that holds the building onto the concrete pad. Okay. In a mythical perfect world, concrete does have some conductivity, so it acts as a sort of ground, but not a good ground. And remember that whole current divider. Here's the thing to think about for reference, and I'll get to it again in a bit. A 2-gauge wire has a pretty low resistance per foot. A 4-inch strap has less than half of that resistance per foot, which means that I can run double the current through that same 4-inch strap and have the same voltage built across, okay? E equals I times R. This is all we're doing. Again, current divider. Point being that I want my net resistance on the path I want the lightning energy to follow to be as low as physically possible. The resistance on the path I don't want it to go is going to be as high as I can make it. And that's where things like ferrites, because, yeah, I'm going to talk about them at least once. And anybody here got a J1000, one of our little 1 kilowatt AMs? Get the search box with it? A couple did. So you remember with the J1000, when you get the search box, you get this coil of wire, 50-foot length of coax with a connector on it. And the instructions say, don't cut this cable. Use the whole 50 feet, even if it's only 5 feet run. You just leave the rest coiled up. The purpose for that is that the extra wire adds resistance, because the transmitter is the path we don't want the lightning energy going down. So a little extra coax is a good thing. The water bottle filling stations here are the coolest thing ever. That was why I told you about the COVID earlier. So if I start to choke to death up here, you'll understand that I'm not going to die in front of you, I hope. All right. Everybody's seen this picture at least once. When you're doing your grounding, make sure you're connecting to ground. So the guy on the left, or the one on the left site in, I think it was in Indiana, but the engineer was the owner, was the salesperson, was the, it's a one-man shop. Really nice guy. And excellent person. He was putting in this new transmitter, and a buddy of his said, if you don't have a ground rod in a pinch, cold water pipe will do for a ground. Forgot to mention, it had to be a conductive cold water pipe. So he strapped the ground onto the PVC cold water pipe and called it a good day. And then called us when it blew up, because surprisingly to absolutely no one except him, it did blow up. The one on the right is a station owner brazing a strap onto a ground rod because it came loose, because he'd used a clamp connection. I believe I've told you what I think about clamp connections before, too. Okay. Back to Springfield, that was a ground rod driven at a 60-degree angle, not straight into the earth. It didn't even get through the gravel to get to the earth. Ideally, your ground will get into the water, the ground reference, whatever you use, whether it's a ground rod, whether it's a chem rod, I don't care. Ideally, it'll get into the water table. Now, where I live, we're hopefully coming out of the driest spell we've had since we measured records. Okay, we've had half an inch of rain in 3 months. My water table is several hundred feet down right now. Fortunately, my well is 400, so there's a good chance it'll live through it. But yeah, ideally you'll get into the water table. If you're driving at an angle like this, you're not going to get there. So straight down. Exothermic connections, whenever you can. CAD weld, braze, silver solder, silphos. Do not hose clamp a piece of soft-drawn 6-gauge wire, hey, I'm ground radial, onto the base of your galvanized steel tower and assume it will qualify as a ground. Do not twist the ground lead from your mains to the wire from your ground rod and not solder them in any way, shape, or form at all and assume it'll do as a ground. Okay? Site in West Virginia. For reference, in the first 10 years he owned that transmitter, and it's one of ours, he spent, paid about $45,000 for the particular transmitter. In the first 10 years he owned it, he spent $20,000 on parts, not counting engineering time. And he called and said, I got a lemon. And I said, I'm pretty sure you don't, but I'll be out that way, let's take a look. So, tower is on the south side of the building. It's got this one saddle clamp with the 6-gauge soft ground wire, hose clamped onto a ground rod right beside the tower. Okay, the AC ground is on the northeast side of the building, and it's just physically two pieces of wire twisted together, hose clamped to another ground rod. The transmitter ground, which I didn't show, is another 6-gauge wire going out and hose clamped to a third ground rod in the northwest corner of the building. None of these ground rods are tied together. So they have no connection between them, all hit different potentials. When lightning hits the tower, the only path, because no surge protector in the building either, that would make it too easy. So the only path for lightning energy to dissipate once ground potential spikes high is through all the switching power supplies and all the RF amplifiers in the transmitter out to the AC lines. We told them to connect the three rods together, bond the actual connections, and put in a surge box. Amazingly enough, that was a year and a half ago. We've had zero parts calls from that station in a year and a half. And I know that transmitter's still there and on the air. So it's the little things. Okay, the surge box is critical. And why the surge box is critical is because every transmitter site in the world, almost every transmitter site in the world, some of the high rises, not so much, but most of the ones sitting out in a field, AC comes in from the road, towers in the backyard. Hang all the stuff you don't want to explode in the middle. What could possibly go wrong? So lightning hits that big, several hundred foot or thousand foot lightning rod in the backyard, heads to earth. Now, if it's an AM, you have some blocking stuff in there. If it's an FM, the tower is grounded. It's all going straight into earth. Earth potential, because earth, again, has a resistance per foot. You run several hundred thousand amps of current through it. That creates voltage. Potential spikes high. Okay? At some point, it's going to have to go elsewhere to dissipate. It goes outward. And if it happens to go outward and see a nice, easy, cushy path through a transmitter to a bunch of grounds on the AC line, that's where it's going to go. So our goal, every time we do this, is to take that and create that. And I could probably reduce this entire portion of the presentation down to an animation just going like this. Because if you can create that, you will pretty much eliminate lightning failures. Now, you're not going to stop 100%, because it is a current divider game, which means there is some ratio of that lightning energy still going through our gear, no matter what. And at some point, if the strike is big enough, that percentage is going to have enough potential to cause failures. It can happen. But you can minimize a pile of it, because what we've done here is the surge protector becomes the path between ground out to the AC lines and vice versa, because you will occasionally get a power line surge. Surprisingly enough, even on the end of the line where you've got pretty dirty power, you don't have that many failure-inducing surges coming in from the power line. Not none, but not that many. So something to be aware of. So all we're trying to do, turn that into that. Sounds easy till you're putting it all together in a site that has evolved over several decades with several different pieces of equipment all tied together by different folks in different ways. That's when we start picking up the phone. Call a friend. Reach out. I'm happy to answer questions whenever I can. Doesn't even have to be on my gear. I will absolutely do my best to get you the most I can get you out of your existing box. Now, if it's Energionics, we'll have a discussion about cost of operation and various other things, but I'll still help you. You know, it's in my best interest. So getting back to the ground resistance. A lot of people are like, well, we've got good ground here, good ground conductivity. When's the last time you measured it? If you haven't measured it, you don't know, because it does change. Now, the cool thing, Florida has got, surprisingly, absolute terrible ground conductivity because it's so much sand. But you can drive a ground rod anywhere in the state, and at 8 feet, you're in the water table, so it doesn't matter what the ground conductivity is. Up here, you got to go a little further to get into the water table. So it's useful to know what your ground conductivity is. I mean, most people think, well, for AM, you need to know what ground conductivity is if you're doing a proper coverage map over and above just using the FCC's maps, which are woefully outdated. I don't know if anybody's talked about that this session or not, but this is the kind of thing that's useful. And Fluke and several other people sell those things. You can actually get out there and measure this stuff. It's really cool to know. This is where I was, and I'm not going to read the wall of text, but the resistance when I was talking current divider. So highlights of it, like I said, if you look at a 12-gauge wire like the electrician will run for the little green safety wire when he runs your new transmitter in, you got about 1.6 milliohms per foot. When you compare that to the 63 microohms per foot of a 4-inch strap, that's a very, very, very big difference in lightning protection right there. So that's the kind of thing we want to pay attention to. Okay, cooling. How many people air conditioner? How many people use forced air? How many people have sites with one or the other or both in some cases? I knew Doc did, so I was waiting to see the hand there because he knew I was going to call you. The thing I see done, I guess, wrong the most at sites, and I did run into one here not too long ago. Is Eric in here today? He was? He probably knew I was coming. Walked into one of his sites, had a GV15 sitting there. And I said, ooh, this transmitter could use a little more cooling. And on the other side, there's an air duct, and there is nothing in there on the air, nothing running. And I said, huh, well, we don't need all this cool air coming in here. So I grabbed a big old plate, shoved it over the air duct, and wrapped tape over it, and wrote, Jeff says, leave me. And I think it's still there like that. Point being that the airflow is as important as how much air you're moving. Probably more important. A lot of times we'll see sites, let's see if I got it in here. There it is. Okay, click past the stupid animations. There. A lot of times, like in the top picture, I'll see air blowing by something at 100 miles an hour instead of going through it. And the problem is you're creating a negative pressure zone. You're actually, if anything, pulling air away from the equipment. So I've seen transmitters in rooms that were at meat locker temperatures, 60 degrees, where the transmitter was overheating because it's starved for air. The air's not going through it. It doesn't matter how cool you keep the room. And here's the thing that you need to remember. When you're working with an HVAC tech, HVAC folks are conditioned, mentally conditioned. This is all their training, is keep the people cool and comfortable. I don't give a single crap about the people in the transmitter building. I want the equipment cool and comfortable. Okay? I mean, I do care about the people, but it's the equipment that's got to be cool. Run all of the air through the equipment. If the room gets warm, who cares? But if the transmitter's sitting at 55 degrees and the room's at 90, I guarantee you it'll cost you a lot less in maintenance than the other way around. Okay, the bottom picture. Anybody using mini splits are a good example, but the Bard, and I'm not picking on Bard intentionally. Yeah, I see John. Bards are built 180 degrees out of phase for what we want to do for cooling broadcast equipment, because they're built so that the cool air goes out the top and filters down because cool air sinks. And then the warm air returns at the bottom to pull it back and cycle and do it again. And it's great for cooling homes and offices because nobody gets a breeze in their face and everybody's nice and cool. Almost every broadcast transmitter out there, especially the full rack size ones, takes the air in the back or the front and dumps the hot air out the top. So in a situation like that, all you're doing is getting the hot air competing with the cool air before it even gets out there to cool anything. And then you're pulling the air away from the transmitter with the warm air return. So if you have a situation like that, invest $1,500 in an HVAC tech or some guy with a pair of sheet metal snips, tin snips, and a rivet gun, and reverse your goes into and goes out of. So that the cool air goes out low into the directly aimed at the equipment you're cooling, whatever it is, and you're sucking the hot air from ceiling height, which is where all gear pretty much exhausts. Okay, that will save you a whole lot of grief. Two things. Number one, your air conditioner will run a whole lot more efficiently, which means cheaper because it's not cycling as often. Number two, your equipment will live a whole lot longer, which means cheaper because you're not paying to fix it as much, okay? I'll give you an example. I had a guy give me a call a couple of days ago, and he's got an issue with a fairly new transmitter, and I said, he's got power supply failures. And it's like, this particular model doesn't typically have a lot of supply failures. That's weird. So I go, well, what's the supply temperature like? Well, I don't know. Well, what does it say in the logs? Well, I don't know. Well, can you log into the transmitter and take a screenshot and email it to me? Power supplies are running at about 60 degrees Celsius. For reference, that is about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. That's pretty toasty. Okay, that's warm. That's way warmer, so the electrolytics are starting to fail because electrolytic capacitors have a life cycle, and that life cycle is dramatically impacted by temperature. Okay, fans have a lifespan, and that lifespan is dramatically impacted by temperature. And those are the two things that will fail most in a switching power supply. All right. For what it's worth, our last Waves newsletter was a couple of weeks ago, and I posted some info from an engineer down in Alabama who rebuilt some switching supplies out of our older NV series. He recapped them and got them working again for a couple of $100 for two of them. Better price than the $1,000 or so we'd charge for two rebuilds, so I'd say good deal. But yeah, airflow is important. Having enough air is important too. And so we'll skip back to the math just for a second. Anybody wants a copy of this? I'm pretty sure chapter 24, you all still host the recordings and the PowerPoints on site after the conference? Patrick's nodding like that's a yes. We're going to call it a yes. If you can't find it, shoot me an email. I'm happy to send you a copy of it. Okay, now the thing to remember with this is that if you call a manufacturer and say, how much air conditioning do I need? I will tell you exactly how much heat that transmitter produces and how much air conditioning you need for that transmitter. If you've got it in a tin shack in the middle of a cornfield in Iowa, that adds a whole different layer of air conditioning requirement from convection heat that I am not factoring into my number at all. So if I tell you you need a 5-ton air conditioner and you buy a 5-ton air conditioner, do not be surprised if that thing dumps in the middle of July, because what you really needed was a 7- or 8-ton air conditioner for your building. So know your building, know your environment. I think it was about 2018. Did I put the link in here? I did. That's not the one I want. Nope. Let's try one more. There it is. Aha. So ignoring the animations again. That link at the bottom, John Marcon worked with FBBC in the Philippines for a lot of years. He's in Arkansas at the moment, but he wrote an excellent article in Radio World about cooling, and he includes all of the math for figuring out convection heat and he quantifies the heat from the sun, the environment, from everything. So it's a great article, definitely worth a read. Okay, and he covers the math way beyond me and my transmitter math. The cool thing about this job is that I get to meet a lot of people smarter than me to talk about the stuff that I don't know much about. And I can just post links up and let you go look at it at your leisure. Here's the other thing. How many people have more people working on site? You folks from Minnesota can keep your hands down for this one, but how many people have more employees in their group than anybody else? It's rare. You know, we got lower budgets, we got fewer people, we're running around, it's real easy to just leave stuff lie. And I tell the story over and over about the one site I was at in Kentucky where I am 100% convinced the engineer was trying to commit suicide, because all the electrical panels had the covers removed. There was loose pieces of Schedule 90 conduit laying on the floor waiting for somebody to take a ride into the open panel. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Take the time to strap stuff down. Okay? 100% of our injuries at the office that are not electrically related have been because somebody forgot to put a tool away or tie something down. 100% of our electrical injuries has been because somebody trusted somebody else when they said the breaker was off. We've had 3 electrical injuries in the 35 years I've been with this company. All 3 of them have been because somebody said a breaker was off and somebody else believed them. Trust nobody. For 2 reasons. Maybe the breaker is off, except for that pole that's welded shut. You ever have a 3-phase breaker with 1 phase welded shut? That stuff will get your attention the first time you screw it up. Trust but verify. Every time I measure everything, I won't put my hands in anything electrical until I've stuck a meter across it. Partly because somebody who looks like he should know a lot better may or may not have been working on a Heathkit signal generator a few years back, playing with one in the collection. May or may not have been using a grounded tip soldering iron, and may or may not have forgotten to unplug the damn thing. That was a light show. That was highly entertaining. Let's just say everything is unplugged and verified to be unplugged and discharged. You always hear me talking about the discharge stick, using a grounding stick on everything, especially on AM, anything with high voltage in it. But yeah, measure everything. Physical security. Now, somebody made the comment. I said, I've taken pictures of this site. That was the second one. I've taken 3 pictures over 5 years. The only thing that's changed is the number of vines on the outside of the building, depending on what time of year it was. Under this peeled back piece of tin roof, there's $160,000 worth of transmitter with a tarp over it. The tarp has changed color in the past 5 years. It's a different tarp. But the roof's still the same. The grass is still as high. Now, somebody said, yeah, but do they have anybody breaking in to steal the copper? Because it looks abandoned. And it's like, well, maybe not. But it's $160,000 worth of gear just sitting in there waiting for that tarp to give way in a rainstorm. Okay, so take some care to the physical security. It's proven over and over again the well-lit places tend to get vandalized less. Throw signs up that say you got cameras. Maybe put cameras up, doesn't matter if the signs are there. Cameras are cheap, though. Alex, where's Alex? Alex has got to be in here somewhere. There he is. Alex had a site in Grand Marais, okay, Minnesota, just north of Duluth. Sent me a picture, and I've used it here before on one of my site ones, of a Harris transmitter with snow drifted halfway up the front of the transmitter because the front door was open. Turns out that those little $29 Wise cams will work in sub-zero temperatures. They're only rated for indoor use. I wouldn't want to pour water on it, but if you've got it relatively sheltered, they work really well. They've got a PTZ version now for under $50. I mean, there's so, you know, cameras are cheap. They won't do anything to stop the guy breaking in. I mean, unless you open the microphone and start talking to him in the process, which you can do. But at least you'll have a record. Okay, maybe a little less so up here, depending on what markets you're in, but a lot of markets, bulletproof peepholes are becoming important. I didn't even know such a thing existed until I saw this at a site in, Washington, Everett, Washington. You may have read the story. This had been 10, 15 years ago. Guy was building, and it was in a wetland. He'd done all the EPA stuff. He'd gone through all the hoops, all the bells and whistles, taken all the precautions, but Earth First was opposed to it. So they pushed over 2 of his towers with a bulldozer. What kind of nerve do you have to push over a 300-foot AM tower by leaning against the base with a bulldozer blade? Do you know what happens to a guide tower when you push the bottom off the insulator? He only got 2 of the 4 towers because turns out the second one landed on the bulldozer. Fortunately for him, he got out of the way in time. Anyway, so this site is the poster child for security. They've got anti-climb fencing. It's got a 1-inch gap instead of a 2-inch gap, so you can't climb it with running shoes. They've got razor wire on everything. This is something else. I mentioned earlier, we're in our driest year ever. 2 years ago, we had our wettest and driest year ever up until that point, because we went through 2 months with absolutely no rain when the whole province was on fire, and then we went with 2 months with all the rain. More and more, we've got to start planning for that. The site in the top right is Saginaw, Michigan, hence the SGW. But it's intriguing because they built a moat, built a dike around. They built it to the 100-year flood level. The next year, they got a 100-year flood. And turns out, if you build a dike, you've also built a swimming pool. All it needs is to be breached. And that's what happened. Okay, the one on the left is in Arkansas. It's Memphis technically, but Mississippi River Delta. They've had the water all the way up to the landing. That's a 40-foot lift. Okay, so know your environment. And this is critical, especially if you're moving into a new area and taking over engineering in a different place than where you've been before. And like where I live, my wife laughs, because my wife grew up here in Sheboygan. I was telling her about the microclimates we have, and she goes, oh yeah, we have those in Wisconsin, and especially when I lived in Red Wing, Minnesota, up the Mississippi, we have microclimates all over, right? You guys know what they're like. I said, honey, you have no idea. So she calls me one day, I'm on the road, and she goes, you're never gonna believe it. And I said, I've been around a while, I believe a lot. She goes, it's sunny and 70 here at the house. And I go, okay, yeah, it's October, it could be, sure. She goes, I just went into town, it's snowing. And I said, okay. She goes, it's 3 miles away. That's microclimates. But pay attention to that. Like I said, learn the environment for where you are. Told you we were going to talk about it. I used the old picture just because I submitted this to, because Kyle is super, super focused on making sure the trains run on time, and he does an amazing job. For those of us that like to submit stuff as we walk up to the podium, it's a challenge. So this is three products that I looked at a couple of years ago. Like I said, this morning I checked on Barracks, and they were down to 608. So the website, for anybody who doesn't know it, is shodan.io, shodan.io. And you can open up you don't even have to have an account to search. You can search anything. It'll show you how many there are of that name, whatever it is. Like I say, at Nautel this morning, there were 18, which is 17 too many, because one of them is a honeypot in our office that IT sets up specifically to look for people searching for Nautel. But we're sneaky like that. Canadians, you gotta watch them. But yeah, this is something we should not be seeing. When a TP-Link router, the cheapest $50 TP-Link router that you can buy at Walmart, has a VPN engine built into it, I should not be seeing broadcast equipment visible on the public internet. Okay, I mean, there are people like Doc, like Alex, like any of the Northwestern guys. There's so many people that can tell you how to configure a VPN. And the fact that I'm still seeing it is just astounding. The fact that I'm seeing fewer than I did 2 years ago is better, but the right number is zero. Now, here's the kind of challenge you run into when you start doing this. So I'm searching for Nautel, and I see this, and I go, well, what's that? Whoops, okay. Well, what that is, 8080 was their TP-Link router. 8443 was their Nautel transmitter. 8889 was their Barracks RDS encoder. And 99.99, if I remember, and I'm guessing at this point, was their STL. But just from that one hit, searching for Nautel, I had the ability to control what went on the air, what was visible on the dashboard. I could lock them out of their own network, and I could tie everything up so the only way they could change was to physically go there and unplug it. There are a lot of sites where they don't always have, I mean, my site, my station back home, there's about 3 months of the year where I cannot guarantee I can get to my site quickly. It's about a 3-hour walk through 2 feet of snow in a good chunk of the time. It's an unplowed road that we don't own. So, you know, or you grab a snow machine. Point being, you should not have your equipment configured so that any Joe can get into it and lock you out of it. Absolutely do not do that. It's like I timed it this way. Hit the 1 minute mark on the thing. So that's it in a nutshell. Like I say, site hardening is just doing what we all know we're supposed to do anyway. But as we got fewer and fewer of us working more and more hours, it's probably becoming more critical than it ever was before. So that is what I had. Oh, Alex has got his hand up already. By the way, Greg said, and I'm going to paraphrase a little here because he's a Marine, so I like to use small words. But Greg said that he's got the mic, so make him run as much as he possibly can because he hasn't had any exercise since he left the Corps. Something like that. Maybe I paraphrased it incorrectly. I've been sick. I'm misunderstanding. What's up, Alex?
So going back to the cameras, one thing I want to reiterate and restate is that your life is not worth the equipment, first and foremost. So we did have a break-in, copper thief, with those WISE cameras. And yeah, I called the sheriff. Sheriff came out, and they were already long gone, but we had camera footage to hand the sheriff. They apprehended him within 12 hours. So being able to keep an eye from afar, I had that camera there to stare at the front of the transmitter. Just so happened I caught their face while they were ripping the pallets out of my transmitter. So they knew everything that they needed to do to go find these guys. But again, not worth your life to go and try and stop them. That's their job. Going to that second point, I make good friends with my local sheriff and police department. I tell them to come on out, take a look around. This is what normal looks like. If this gate is open, come back and make sure we're okay. You don't know if we put our hand in the wrong place. Right. You know, just come check on us. If you see something that's not normal, do what you do.
Other really, really good point about that, and I know we got a couple extra minutes that I'm going to borrow, but another really, really good point about that is making sure that your site either has a proper civic address or has some way of identifying that the local first responders are aware of, because there are a lot of the county roads where the civic address is near the tower. Yeah, Doc.
I just recently had some signs printed up, and it's really cheap to do, where you can put in the tower ID number, but it also has our phone number and an email address. And we had a situation at one of our remote sites where the gate was open, and the deputy saw the number and called it, which rang my house, and said, hey, here's what I'm seeing. Do you want me to check it out? So that's another good tip if you have, you know, sites that are kind of out in the middle of nowhere, is put a sign on there. First of all, you have to have a tower ID anyway, the ASR, but put contact information on there and make sure it's current. And that then, if you, you know, in an area like this where it's really remote, you never know who's going to stop by. So you don't always, you know, you can't always just depend on knowing the sheriff or whatever. Just a general number where somebody can call and say, hey, something's going on, and then you can go from there.
Yeah, and like for our site, for example, one of the things we did, we hosted a barbecue for the local volunteer fire department, and they came out in their personal vehicles, and they got to see what our site road looks like, and they realized really quickly there was no way they'd ever get a pumper truck back to our site if they needed to. So they've made some concessions. We put a water cistern back up there to catch rainwater just specifically because if we ever have a fire back there, we're not getting a truck up that road, and we know it. It was really funny when the Industry Canada folks came in to inspect with their minivan and high-centered it halfway to the site.
Oh, on overnight work, and I know that we as an industry are moving away from overnight work, but sometimes it still comes. I like to call the local non-emergency number of law enforcement, say, I'm going to be out at our site on such and so road, give the address, and here's my license plate number, and anybody who's out on patrol is welcome to stop by and verify this.
Yep, yep. It's always good to have, anytime you're doing late night stuff, have a call out system too, just for general health and welfare checks over and above the that part. Okay, one last one. If anybody else got anything? Nothing? Right on time. Folks, thank you very much.